You could be drunk on more than just alcohol. You could get drunk on your emotions. You could be drunk on your passions. Passions, those kind of like knee-jerk, spontaneous snap reactions that we have to stuff, whether it's anger or fear or desire. These are these emotions that kind of are really, really powerful, and we can kind of, they can get us by the throat. When those rise up, sober-mindedness says, I'm not gonna be morally, physically impaired by those emotions. I'm gonna keep my head. Sober-mindedness is commended as a kind of anchor virtue, where it's always in the list of what elders must be, for example.
This is the Made to Advance podcast. I'm your host, Brian Olick. We're here to inspire and equip you for your best future. Well, hey, welcome everybody. So good to be with you today. And before we get started with an incredible conversation to come, just want to ask you a favor. If you could rate and review our show, that would be such a great help. It helps us reach more and more people, and it also helps us bring on more incredible guests. Today I have with me Dr. Joe Rigney, who is a theologian, author, and is currently a fellow of theology at New St. Andrews College. He has written many great books, but two of my absolute favorites are Leadership and Emotional Sabotage and The Sin of Empathy, subtitled Compassion and Its Counterfeits. I just told Joe, The Sin of Empathy, I read on the beach. Now, I don't know what you think, everybody listening, but if you can read The Sin of Empathy on the beach, that's a good book, all right? Joe joined the Engedi Church staff for a training session, and what he shared was so good that I wanted to get it out to our Made to Advance audience. And so, Joe, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Brian.
It's great to see you again. And I was wondering, I was thinking about this with you being a fellow at New St. Andrews. Are you actually based in Idaho now?
Oh, yeah. So I live in Moscow, up here in the chimney of Idaho.
Okay. Now, this is going to be ignorance talking. I've been to a lot of states, never been to Idaho. But when it comes to like what there is to do in Moscow, Idaho, I just imagine cornfields. I don't know why. I'm basing that on nothing. What do you do?
It's not cornfields. It'd be wheat and some other crops. But it looks like Narnia. So it's like rolling hills with pine forests on mountains, kind of in the background. You move north and you get up into like it's right next to Spokane, Coeur d'Alene. Coeur d'Alene's this great lake. There's another lake right up Lake Pendere. These French lakes, basically, and they're like the deepest lakes ever. So I'm pretty sure they did submarine testing in Lake Pendere. It's like 2,000 feet deep in a mountain range thing. So it's like mountains and lakes and pine forest and wheat fields. It's beautiful.
Wow. So absolutely beautiful. And I'm guessing then, is it low population, all things considered?
Yeah, like, Moscow is a town of about 25 to 30,000, with the University of Idaho is making up about 10,000 of that. So it's a small town with a big university. Washington State University is right across the state line from us, about eight miles away. And that's where Wazoo is. So Pullman and Moscow are kind of little twin cities across the border. And then you've got Spokane and Coeur d'Alene, which is north, and that's kind of twin cities, but bigger. And other than that, that's kind of all you got. Lots of little small towns. It's great.
Gotcha. Well, that sounds good. It does sound very Narnian. So
that's right.
Well, I'd love to spend some time talking about some of your books today, a couple of them in particular. And since we last talked, The Sin of Empathy has been released. And as I said in the intro, just absolutely so appreciated that book. But it's funny, you know, you title a book The Sin of Empathy, and already, you know, people are like, who is this guy? What's he think he's doing calling empathy a sin? What kind of mean guy is this that would title a book in such a way? So
explain yourself.
Yeah, exactly. I know defining our terms is such a big deal. So maybe you could begin by just for the folks who are going, what in the world is this book about? Maybe you could begin just by unpacking a little bit of what you mean by the sin of empathy.
Yeah, maybe two ways into it to kind of orient people. One would be empathy, pity, compassion, that emotional response, like all of our emotional responses, can be either good or bad depending. Okay, so I mean, you think about something like anger. Everybody recognizes that there's a good kind of righteous anger. Christ had that, and we've had that. Maybe rarely, but we've had it. But then there's an ungodly anger. There's a holy fear, and there's an unholy fear. The Bible talks about a godly grief and a worldly sorrow that leads to death. So these emotions all have good or bad versions. And the basic argument of the book is that empathy is no different. Compassion and pity are no different. There is an ungoverned, untethered, version of these emotions that is deeply harmful and destructive. And because compassion is such a good thing when it's good, often it can hide really easily and be sneaky destructive. So that's one way in. The other way would be to say, I think over the last, 30, 40, 50 years, there's been a kind of linguistic migration that's sort of interesting, as this older word like sympathy or compassion has kind of given way to this newer term, empathy, as a kind of improvement. And I'm kind of interested in that, like what's going on there. Sympathy is this old word. It's like been around forever. It's in your Bible. It was in the King James Bible. But in the last 50 years or so, there's been a notion that like sympathy is not quite good enough. Mm-hmm. There's a better response to people in pain than just sympathizing with them. I actually got an email from someone who was, saw the title and emailed, found my email somehow and said, what's the deal? I think empathy is good. Christ didn't come to sympathize with us from afar. And it was an interesting tip, because I was like, why would you think that sympathizing would be from afar? Why is it that in your head the word sympathy means aloof, uncaring, distant, whereas empathy means like I'm really in? And so that's where I kind of came up with this analogy that if someone's drowning in quicksand, there's sort of three basic responses you could have to them. One would be apathy. You don't care. You walk by on the other side of the road like the guys in the parable of the Good Samaritan. Obviously, that's the bad kind. But then there's another response that would be good, where you would reach in to help them out, but you would also remain anchored to the shore so that you could have something to brace on. So you grab a branch, a tree, you throw a life preserver, and you get in there with them, but you also are holding on, you're tethered and anchored in order to help them. And I would call that sympathy or compassion. Mm-hmm. And then empathy would be if you just jumped in there with both feet and you just dove in, and now there's two people drowning in quicksand. And so this more total immersion in another person's feelings, pain, and suffering that sweeps you off your feet to where you lose touch with what is true and what is good, that's what I mean by the sin of empathy.
That's a great explanation. And I know you kind of get into this a little bit in the book when you're talking about how Brené Brown, in some ways, in her own way, starts to put empathy over and above sympathy. Right. Now, to your credit, I appreciate that you nuanced that even Brené, there's a little bit of
footnotes
pushing in both directions. Yeah. So, but explain to me why, to our listeners, why is the culture or some in our culture arguing that empathy is like the new and improved sympathy? What's so wrong with sympathy? I mean, why would anybody have a problem with that or believe empathy is the next best thing?
Yeah, I think that there's two things going on there. One is people hate to be pitied. They want pity, but they hate to be pitied. No one likes it, because the idea of being pitied is I'm hurt and sad and you're not, and you're condescending to join me. But there's this kind of asymmetry that people kind of naturally recoil from. And this is why people, when they're hurting, can make these impossible demands. Like, I want you to feel bad for me, but I don't want you to like feel bad for me. And there's this, and people can kind of be put on a guilt trip, but then be, yeah, all this kind of stuff. So I think that's one reason, is that sympathy preserves a kind of, there's a person who's suffering and a person who's helping. And that thing people don't like. So I think that's one element. I think the other is that we live in a kind of subjectivist age where people's feelings are taken to be the standard of truth. So you think about, even Brené Brown uses language like, empathy stays out of judgment and lets people have their truth. And that language of your truth or my truth, mm-hmm, is a kind of relativistic notion. And so in a relativistic age, people want their feelings to be in the driver's seat, and no one can tell me that my feelings are wrong, or that what I feel is bad, or that what I just said out of my emotions was in any way inappropriate. And so we resist that kind of judgmentalism in a relativistic age. And I think both those reasons are why sympathy was disparaged. Brené Brown basically made a video called The Sin of Sympathy, and nobody cared. Right. Lots of Christians just gobbled it up and used it in their college ministry trainings. I knew people who did this, and I'm like, but that sympathy word's in your Bible. Like, it's in there, like a lot, actually. And she's calling it bad. Don't you think that's a problem? Well, but she's saying that there's a better thing. And that's where you really get this kind of subtle cultural shift to the privilegings of feelings, and that sets the stage for what I think has happened, which is empathy becomes a power tool in the hands of the sensitive. It becomes a tool of emotional blackmail and manipulation. That's where we actually are. But it required this kind of verbal linguistic cover so that most people don't recognize it till it's too late.
It's funny. I was literally just in our church lobby a couple of weeks ago, and a guy came to me who's in a very hurting place financially. And he was asking questions about how we can help him and these kinds of things. And I said something just sort of trying to validate some of the feelings he might be having being in as hard of a place he was. And he was very clear. I don't want you to pity me. I don't want you to feel. So he's you know, and it's this weird thing, like you're coming to me for help. But I wasn't asking me for emotional help in the moment. He was asking for more tangible financial help. But I was trying to sort of enter that space of recognizing he's a real human with emotions. But boy, it's like, I don't want that.
Not that.
I don't need your pity. You know, just I need your money. I'm sorry to be crass, but
yeah, right. No, and I think that's a real phenomenon where, and I think, you know, that's as old as dirt. So I think one of the things about the book is I try to address the dynamics. And it doesn't matter what labels you put on it. So the modern term, I think, is this sympathy-empathy contrast. And by empathy, I mean the untethered kind. Some people just mean empathy by, like, it's the same thing. They're just synonyms. But, like, you know, you go back 50 to 100 years, and G.K. Chesterton and C.S. Lewis are both talking about the same phenomenon using the language of pity or mercy.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is as old as dirt, and anybody who's ever been on the receiving end of a pity party knows that, you know, or a guilt trip, that that people can basically use the fact that you care for them and that you want to be kind to them, and they can use it to their advantage to try to manipulate you into getting their way. And I would just say that's a human tendency, and we need to resist it. But the modern distinction is, I think, we've institutionalized this weaponization. Mm-hmm. And it basically steered not only, you know, a family that was subjected to, you know, a mother who put her kids on a guilt trip or something. There's that's forever. But now it's like, no, we've had an entire civilization, churches, schools, nations that have been subjected to this kind of empathetic manipulation.
Give us some examples of that, Joe. They're so funny. I'm taking notes as we go because there are things I want to come back to, but let's keep running with that. Give us some examples of where you see, I want our listeners to really understand why this is an urgent conversation, because if you just hear, empathy, sympathy, you know, that's a nice, you know, whatever conversation, but actually this is profoundly important for the cultural moment we're in. Maybe you could give some examples about how you see the weaponization of empathy play out.
Yeah. So I think, you know, if you start out at the political or cultural level, the debates that we've had over the last 10 years or so about all things, what's now called wokeness, I think an undercurrent in all of the different manifestations of that was this untethered empathy dynamic and manipulation. So the extreme end, you've got the trans phenomenon where a person's subjective feelings about their so-called gender identity is out of accord with their biological reality, God-given biology. But we have to sort of privilege their feelings over against reality. And so their feelings matter more than what's true and real, even to the point of doing great harm to them. So we're going to catechize kids into this and then castrate them or give them surgery or chemicals to inhibit puberty. So that would be a good example where, and if you try to resist it, if you say, no, this isn't good, we're not going to indulge your fantasies, what will you be accused of? And the answer is you're being heartless, cruel, you're not having empathy. And so empathy becomes the way that the trans movement was able to maneuver its way into the heights of power and everybody oriented around them so that we have to use preferred pronouns. And I mean, and I think people have a sense that, like, oh, there's been this backlash to this phenomenon and it's, you know, it's going to go away. And I go, well, it's some places maybe, but Colorado just passed a law that said it's a crime to misgender someone or to dead name them, to call them. If you called Caitlyn Jenner Bruce Jenner, you could get fined or go to jail. And so it's still there, and it's based on, like, these people are hurting, they're suffering, this is a really hard, since having gender dysphoria is a really hard thing, and therefore we have to accommodate their subjective feelings. So that'd be one example. But even if you move back a step in our cultural, in the highway to hell, basket that we're on, you go back a step to the gay marriage debates of, 15, 20 years ago. And this was entirely the mechanism by which the left was able to get those things, both at the judicial and the legislative level. You know, these people just want to be, they love each other and they don't have the same privileges as you do. Don't you feel bad for them? And so if you withhold, if you say, no, marriage is only a man and a woman, then aren't you being hurtful to them? And look at the sad faces. And so that was an effective tool there. And you could just work your way back. But the same thing would be true of like the race conversations. I think when we had basically victim classes, and in some cases, there really was historic evils and injustices done. I'm not denying that. But the issue is, how is that then leveraged and used so that, in a church setting, you may have felt it in, sometime between 2014 and 2022 in a conversation about race where it's really fraught and tense. And there's a notion that if you're white, you don't get to have a say here anymore, because you need to listen to the victims of the oppression, and the victims of the oppression set the agenda for the entire community. And if you were to say, well, wait a minute, I thought we're collaborators. We're all co-laboring together to pursue racial harmony. Wait a minute. No, you'd get shut mm-hmm. down for asking those questions, because you were privileging you had your white privilege or whatever. And it was all of that woke language, like running under the surface, was this emotional dynamic where power was leveraged to the biggest victims, which mm-hmm. is why you had what I've affectionately come to call the victimhood Olympics, where people competed to be who can be the greatest victim on the intersectional critical theory scale, because the greatest victim wins. The greatest victim is invulnerable to challenge and sets the agenda for the whole community. So those would be some ways out in the culture that I think you see that dynamic in play. And then there's others that we could talk about that get a little more finely tuned in families and churches.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's bring it down again, just because some people are going to live and are very tuned into the 30,000 foot macro level cultural issues. But what are some of the ways you see this playing out in more, if for somebody kind of in their everyday relationships, what does it look like when empathy is weaponized?
Yeah, so there's some great examples in the book that, C.S. Lewis was just a master at this. And so he talks about the way that, I used a mother earlier, but it could be a dad or it could be a sibling or whatever, but a family member, but let's use mother, basically puts her family on a guilt trip and tries to wield their pity against them in order to get her way. One of the examples from The Great Divorce is a husband who was always trying to like put on the long face and talk about his sufferings in order to manipulate his wife. And, it's The Great Divorce is a conversation between dead people, the saints and the damned, having this conversation. He's damned. She's a saint. And now she's invulnerable to this kind of manipulation. And she has to tell him, like, stop using pity the wrong way around. Like, mm-hmm. pity is supposed to be this kind of prod or this spur that spurs joy to help the miserable. Like, there's somebody hurting. Joy's happy, but go get them. That's the proper use. But you're using it the wrong way around as a kind of emotional blackmail, where I will be sad unless you do what I say. Mm-hmm. And because you don't want me to be sad, you'll go along with it. You'll tell lies. You'll fudge the truth, or you'll walk on eggshells in order to avoid having them erupt. And you can count on other people in the family to kind of police you to make sure that you don't draw clear lines and have some courage and fortitude to resist those manipulations. So I think those would be ways in family dynamics that you could kind of see the way that basically emotions are wielded in order to get your way, based on this idea that, like, you need to share my emotions and my emotions are in your driver's seat.
Yeah, that's so good. I think that for many people, the notion of a virtue – we'll call it a virtue such as empathy, even defined in the best way, or let's say closest to compassion and sympathy, the notion that a virtue can be a bad thing just feels right. counterintuitive to many of us.
Yeah.
One of the things you've talked about, and you already referenced it with some of C.S. Lewis's works, is really any virtue, even the ones we think yeah. most positively of, become toxic and dangerous and damaging the moment they're not tethered to other virtues. Could you unpack that, and specifically love? But this is something I've heard you do before, talk about before, is like, hey, for this virtue, you need that, because the moment you get one in isolation, you get into problems.
Yeah.
And maybe you could spell that out a little bit more for
yeah.
us.
Yeah, so Chesterton has this great quote where he talks about the modern world is full of the old Christian virtues gone mad, and they become mad because they've wandered away from each other. They're not anchored. It's not a package. So you think about like the fruit of the Spirit. It's like at one level, there's these nine things in that list, but it's like you can't go, well, I'm going to take 2, 5, and 7, but 1, 4, and 6, no thank you. Like it's a package deal that kind of comes together as the Spirit works in our lives. If you try to isolate them, then they go crazy and they become destructive. Or Lewis has a great one about mercy detached from justice grows unmerciful, right? And he says, because it, you know, this mercy is great, but it needs to be kind of like planted in the rocks of justice. It needs to have this like hard edge justice. Otherwise, it becomes mere sentimentality. And he calls it a man-eating weed that devours everything in its path. When it gets kind of transplanted from the rocks of justice to the swamps of humanitarianism. And so those are good examples of the need for virtues to be anchored to each other and ultimately anchored to Christ, anchored to God. Like
yeah.
what is ultimately true and good? Anytime you take these emotional elements, these emotional habits, and they're not governed, God's hand's not on the rein, they become demons. That's what Lewis actually says this explicitly. His book, The Four Loves, the entire premise of that book is that natural loves, when God's hand is not on the reins, when, in other words, when natural loves set themselves up as God, he says they become demons.
Wow.
Right. Natural loves. And he walks through and he's like, family loves, like mother love or father love, family affection, friendship, romantic love. These are all natural human loves. And when they put themselves in the highest place and they're not governed by divine love, then they become demons and they destroy everything in their path. And what I basically did is I think Lewis is absolutely right. And this is a kind of like basic, like it's only the best things that get corrupted that way. Like the better something is,
mm-hmm.
then the worse it is if it goes bad. And so that principle, I thought, that's exactly right. And then as I'm looking at compassion, sympathy, empathy discussion, and I go, oh, that's what this is. This is love for the weak, the hurting, and the broken, which is good, just like mother love is good and romantic love is good. But if you take God's hand off that rein, all yeah. of a sudden, this love for the weak, the hurting, the broken becomes this tool of manipulation.
That's just such a great way to explain it. And I think that I'm going to ask you a question on this after I give an example of something I just experienced. So let's come back to specifically the virtue of love. I come back to that one just because our culture is in love with love. I mean, it's right. always about, isn't that loving? And don't you just want to love people? And I just got this the other day. We take some stands on biblical principles around here. And so yeah. Like, at times that means you're going to be accused of not being loving. And of course, you know, the moment you're this person was saying that, I want to go, well, what do you mean by love? How are you defining it? What's your standard? And I don't know, would you say that in some ways, what I hear you saying is, hey, you need to balance any one virtue with all the whole set of them. Do you think there is a specific virtue that if you name one virtue, it's like, man, this is really needs to be counterbalanced by this other specific, for example, with love, I immediately go, yes, love in the context of holiness.
Right.
But do you feel like there is always a, I don't want to say a one-for-one counterbalance,
yeah.
but there are these pairs, or do you feel like in general it's the whole constellation that needs to be taken into account?
Yeah, I think it's probably the whole constellation, but I do think, but you're not wrong to say, because when you said it, I think all of us have this, you know, you need to be both grace and truth. And that, you know, there's a Bible, you know, it's John 1, where it talks about Jesus is full of grace and truth. And it kind of pairs them. And we kind of take that to mean like there's the kindness side, but you also need to have a backbone anchored to truth. So grace and truth, love and holiness, things like that, you know, empathy, courage and compassion both together. Mm-hmm. So I think there's ways that you could do that kind of like pairing of them together in order to keep one of them from wandering off and becoming destructive. But truthfully, I do think it's all of the virtues at some level are one thing mm-hmm. as it comes into contact with different situations, right? Yeah. So like, is there a big difference between, you know, pity and mercy? It's like, not really. Like we can kind of, you know, well, mercy's more this, pity's more that, or grace is more this and mercy's more that. So I think that we can do that. I think that's a legitimate a way to operate. But at base, it's like, it's God's presence in you. Mm-hmm. And what we want is just the pieces that suit us. We want the pieces of that pie right. that are like palatable, and we want to then mute the ones that are, you know, a little more hard edged. And every generation, I think, faces different pressures, mm-hmm. Depending on where they are and what's going on. They're like, oh, we're going to be tempted to mute this one in order, and we're going to front load this one. Look at us. And I think this is actually a big part of what happened over the last 15 years. Is I think progressives figured out that this was the way to get Christians to censor themselves, take themselves off the battlefield, mute themselves, was to basically define virtues like compassion and empathy in progressive ways, identify the groups that were worthy of receiving compassion and empathy and which ones weren't, and then evaluating whether Christians are being good Christians according to those new progressive standards. And right. Christians kind of came to adopt that like little progressive on their shoulder, evaluating all of the things that they do.
Yeah, you call this the progressive gaze, living within the progressive gaze. It's a great thing. Unpack it more. Keep going. I don't mean to interrupt you, but I think good. It's a great point. Yeah.
I this is one of the ways that the whole woke thing was helpful was I came across this phrase called the white gaze in the midst of the woke stuff. It was from the author Toni Morrison, who was basically talking about as an author, she's a novelist. Whenever she would write books, there was this kind of felt sense that like her audience, she wanted to write books for like her people, for like black folks, but she kind of felt like actually there's this little white guy on her shoulder who's like evaluating whether or not it makes sense and whether or not like does she need to explain it for him. And she basically said it kind of suffocated her imagination to have this censorious white guy on her shoulder. And so she called that the white gaze and talked about how black authors needed to get out from under the white gaze and just write the book they want to write, which I think is great advice. And I just thought, you know, actually, that's the way a lot of pastors operate. Because the idea of the gaze, whether it's the white gaze or the progressive gaze, or you could have a right wing gaze or a female gaze, there's all the male gaze, all these different gazes. The basic idea is fear of man, like that actual like biblical term for it. But in the modern world, because our society is just shot through with progressive ideology, so like every, you know, 1.5 political parties, every major corporation, the media, Hollywood, education, big ed, all of these industries are by and large run by progressives. What it meant was is that was the little man on the shoulder. The progressive gaze was the one that was saying, hey, Christian, you're not being very Christian because, you know, you're not you're not getting the vaccine, right? Like love your neighbor, get the vax. Or you don't care about climate change. Or and don't you care about polar bears? And don't you care about the future of the planet? So you need to adopt these progressive policies in order to be considered compassionate. Or immigration, or the sexual revolution, or pick your issue. On all of them, it was couched as you're not a compassionate Christian if you don't adopt progressive ideology and policies in relation to these areas. And what was interesting about it is that if someone said, well, you should be compassionate, and you responded by, you mean like to the white working class guy with the red hat, I should be compassionate, I should try to take his concerns on board? If you would have said that in 2019, 2018, people would have said, whoa, no, he's bad, right? he voted for Trump. And so there was this kind of like selectivity. And when you start to press through and realize like, oh, there actually is a rhyme or a reason to why certain groups were favored and could receive empathy and certain groups could not, you begin to see how this great Christian virtue had been co-opted.
Right. Totally. When I read your book, one of the things I thought about was when it comes to kind of these different gazes, I thought of in the modern church, and it depends on what generation you are, but I thought there's almost like at times an unbeliever or a seeker gaze, I might call it,
exactly
where right. you see pastors couching and positioning their messages relative to, you know, the critic, the person outside the church, the whatever, and they're really writing in light of that person, right, as opposed to saying, I'm here first and foremost to disciple God's people. Now, I will always, of course, want to speak very sensitive, and I think that's a biblical idea. I'm thinking specifically out of Corinthians when Paul talks about, hey, be aware there are people of different spiritual backgrounds in the room. We want to be sensitive.
Outsiders,
to that. So, I want to be sensitive to that in my speaking. But I think that sometimes what has happened with preaching is there's like this unbeliever gaze, and now I'm speaking as if they're the ones driving the conversation as opposed to my fundamental task, which is to disciple believers. Does that connect with what you're getting at right now?
It's absolutely, and I think and once you realize it, you realize at some level it is unavoidable. Like you do have a kind of target audience, whether it's your, you know, Christians or certain kinds of Christians or certain unbelievers in your, who might be the likely unbelievers that come. And at some level, calculating your rhetoric in order to make the truth clear to them is a good thing, right? Like anticipating what are going to be the barriers they would face to the Christian faith, to even understanding what it even is. And therefore rhetorically speaking that way, that's good and right. The challenge comes is when you kind of universalize your context, which is part of what happened with the progressive gaze. Whenever people said, hey, the world is watching, what they meant was the secular progressive elite world that lives on the coasts, blue states. Blue state progressives are watching, and therefore everybody needs to calculate their rhetoric accordingly, as opposed to, what about rural folks? Are they watching? Are we laboring to make the Christian faith comprehensible to them, or is it just the elites that matter? And then the other thing is paring down the rough edges in order as a way of kind of, you know, avoiding conflict or avoiding alienating your target audience.
Right.
So you never get around to saying the bits that would be hard for them to hear, the true things that would get them to say, away with such a man from the earth, he does not deserve to live. Like whatever those things are, a lot of times, you know, the gaze is a way of kind of justifying and avoiding saying the truths that will get you angry emails or fired.
Yeah, and we basically end up pulling punches, and you know, I know don't know if that's the best term to use for speaking truth, but at the end of the day, that's what I remember hearing the story. I don't think it was from you. I think it was from someone else, of a pastor I have incredible amounts of respect for, but I think in the hopes of speaking to his audience, sometimes would maybe pull back from some of those topics that potentially could divide. And I, as I recall the story, somebody had been in his church, come to know Christ for a long time, and then some years later, came to understand his or the church's position on such and such topic, and suddenly was like, I don't want to have anything to do with this based on what I just found out. And that just saddened me, because I think that on the one hand, there was, and I'm glad you appreciate the tension, and you named that. On the one hand, I love that he was able to reach her where she was at that time. Right. But by, I think, at some level, perhaps over catering to the gaze, now we're in a situation. And again, everybody, when we're saying gaze, G-A-Z-E is what we're talking about here. I keep
although
thinking.
It is a fun pun, and I think that God intended it from before the foundation of the world.
So, but because of maybe perhaps over catering to that, you know, that's kind of urban elite gaze, then we ended up having some surprises where she did not understand biblical faith fully for what it is.
In that case, the issue was, that it was the idea that, oh, the church believes that homosexuality is a sin or that abortion is a sin. And this was news to her after having been in the church and converting and embracing Jesus, but having never been called to repent of these, you know, evils or of a celebration of these particular evils. And I think in her mind, she rightly felt like there had been a bait and switch. Mm. And it's that sort of thing that I think one of the fruits of any kind of gaze, any kind of fear of man, is by calculating your rhetoric so much that you win people to something, and then they discover that there was like the fine print and there was the footnotes that you never got around to saying because you didn't want to offend them, and they feel like they've been lied to because they have, right? Like that. Like the thing is that when you feel that and you're like, oh, what, you guys believe that too? Yes. I feel like I've been lied to. And so putting it out there and having the boldness and courage to put your finger on the places that people need to repent, I think is just a fundamental, that's like a basic Christian faithfulness in ministry dimension.
I 100% agree with that. Now, here's an interesting thing, and I don't know if you've noticed this or kind of felt this at all, but you talk about the taxonomy of the negative world, positive world, yeah. Neutral world, and that we're in this negative world, this idea that the church or Christian faith's relationship to the culture is one where the culture in mass or at large has a more negative posture towards faith matters. And here's what I've noticed lately, and I don't know if you've picked this up. I feel like at this point in time, I'm paying attention to churches all over the country, and some of the most bold, call it like it is, churches, and I don't mean, you know, they're overly political or anything like that, but they are preaching the hard edges of faith, are seeing some of the most radical amounts of fruit. And I almost wonder, and again, this is just kind of speculation on my part. I almost wonder in the culture that we're in, and it isn't all about negative world stuff. There's a lot of things going on, the level of darkness that's present in our culture. I feel like oddly, in some ways, that kind of hard edge preaching may be resonating at a level at our time that maybe it wouldn't have, say, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. Any perspective on that, Joe?
Yeah, sure. So the three worlds framework from Aaron Wren, where in positive world from like the 50s and 60s up through the 90s, where Christianity is sort of the background, it's cultural Christianity is the background for everybody. Even the non-Christians live in a Christian world. It's the remnant, it's Christendom as it's declining, but it's still potent. And the neutral world from the mid 90s to basically 2014, which was kind of the height of the third way winsome approach to ministry, cultural engagement versus culture war. Both of those had residual cultural Christianity as the kind of background noise for everybody. And so in the negative world was when that background noise was taken to be the problem. Like it's the idea that you think there's a moral law that stands over us at all, or that men are men and women are women, and that the anus is not a sex organ, and all of those kind of like really like things that would have been very obvious a generation or two ago, all of a sudden are not obvious. And in fact, to continue to hold them means that you're a bad person. It's not just that you're wrong, but you're a bad person. That's negative world. And so I think in that context, people, when you reassert reality and you're just like, no, but reality is reality, right? It's marriage is one man and one woman, right? The sexes were designed to complement one another. Men and women are different. And when you just are unwilling to buckle in the face of all of that cultural pressure, it's kind of like the churches that are willing to do that are kind of the last place to find that kind of refreshing like air. And there's a whole bunch of people out there who have been like kind of going along with the cultural winds, kind of questioning in their mind, but not saying anything because you don't want to awaken the mob. And all of a sudden, here's somebody who just stands up and does, "Emperor has no clothes. Like, this is false." And they go, "Okay." And
I'm not crazy.
Like, they're like, "I'm not crazy." And they want to come. And so they start going to your church. I think that that's a big part of why, you know, red pilled churches or churches that have kind of leaned in on some of the cultural issues are growing. I think it's a temporary thing because I think as soon as it, you know, it was bold and bad, you're the bad boy if you believe men are men and women are women. It's like, well, if there's a backlash and all of a sudden that kind of settles a little bit more, you don't have that same pull. But I would say that'd be good. Like it would be good for us to get back to the point where that was a given, that was not a contested statement. I think the other element of it is, so my friend James Wood will talk about like reality respecters as kind of the most, the fields are white for the harvest kind of mission field is, and he compares them to, first century God-fearers. So in the Bible, when you have this, in the book of Acts, you have this category of the God-fearers.
Right.
And basically, this is like, they're Gentiles, but they're Jewish adjacent or synagogue adjacent. They kind of hang around the edges, and they're kind of, at the time, they were like Judaism curious, right? And it seems like when the gospel went through, the two places that it found the most fruitful harvest was either, you know, Jews who were waiting for their Messiah, right? Some of them embraced. And then these God-fearers who were like, you know, curious about the Israel's God, but weren't going to get circumcised and stop eating pork and all of that. But they were like, we like Israel's God. This is interesting. And it was like the gospel just went like wildfire among that group.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, those God-fearers today, that's reality respecters who are the, you know, leftovers of Christendom who kind of go, yeah, men are men and women are women, but they still have, it's all inconsistent and it doesn't have a fully formed biblical foundation, and they're God and country Christians, but like, is it a living faith in Christ? Probably not. It's that group that if you're the person who's willing to just boldly stand on the law of God and then call people to the gospel, might go, they see that it's Christ or chaos. Like they see like, well, I know that that abyss of secular nihilism and moral insanity and castration of kids and all of that, like whatever I want, it's not that. Whatever's not that. And then if you're there going like, well, we're not that. We actually, there's a different, an older, a deeper way of living that tracks with the way God made the world. Let me tell you about Christ. Mm-hmm. You actually might have a hearing if you're bold with it and not simply tepid.
That's so good. And I hope that's encouraging to even pastors who are listening. But and let's just go on record for saying too, even in the case where you have somebody who's not as warm, or I mean, I feel like the audience you're describing, it's a great way to put it, and I think you know they're a you know maybe a click or two away from Christ, and they just need to be kind of brought home and discipled.
Yep.
But just so it's on record of us saying, listen, even for those who are not in that category, it is amazing to me today how when you preach the truth of Christ, there's enough common grace still in somebody's heart that we still see radical conversions from people. Absolutely. Over the exact issues you would expect would repel them, they end up drawing them in because right. There's something in, I would say it's common grace, something in them that resonates that says, you know what, I think this is actually right and true, even if everything my culture is saying is the opposite message. So it's just amazing the grace of God to be able to redeem people and speak to their hearts.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting on that note, like one of the places that this, I think the manhood, womanhood conversation is one that people, I think, often feel very skittish. We live in a feminist, you know, heavily feminist society by and large. And so people kind of tiptoe around that sometimes. And so the idea, like men are the head, they just are. And women are the body, and that's glorious. And they complement one another, but they're different. And all this kind of stuff is a place where pastors, I think, can be very sensitive, especially because of the, you don't want to step on the feminist toes. But what's interesting to me is like somebody sent me the other day a book that's basically a book. It's a secular book, not Christian at all, but written to wives that is basically like how to help, you know, heal your marriage. And the advice in the book is basically like a non-Christian version of Ephesians 5, where it's just like, well, just submit to your husband, you know, and respect and honor him and, encourage him. And like, it's very much like recognize that he's, you know, here's how he works as a man. This is what he values, you know, his vocation really matters to him. And is he providing and is he a man and all these kind of things. And if you affirm those, then that'll help heal your marriage. And so, and you're reading it and you realize like, this is just like basic biblical discipleship of what the Bible says, how men and women should relate. And it's actually like this secular person who's doing it, and she's kind of doing it as though she discovered like, you know, this lost wisdom, you know, like it's like, this is the most amazing. Could you possibly imagine that if you just respected your husband, things might be better for you? But she can actually get away with it because it's not tied to Jesus said so.
Yeah. That's so interesting. Does she base it on, just out of curiosity, does she base it on any kind of social science or anything like that? Or
it's kind of social science and then experience. I've not read the book. Somebody was relaying to me what it was in it and then sent it to me. But it was basically like, I think she was kind of doing the feminist thing and then pivoted and tried something. I'm going to do the opposite.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it was like her marriage got better. And so she was like, wait a minute, what if I've been lied to? And so then she's, you know, kind of encouraging other women like her. And so I think that that is as another example of the very place where you think you have to tiptoe. If you just say like, hey, here's what the Bible says. Mm-hmm. And I think a big part of this for Christians this isn't in either of the books, but it's a principle that we live by out here in Moscow, is to assume the center. And the idea of assuming the center is to treat Christianity, to treat the gospel, to treat God's law as if it was true and good for everybody. Like that's actually like assuming the center is, so as opposed to the way that Christians often orient on some of these issues psychologically, where there's a kind of defensive crouch that we get in, where we're like, hey, we're sorry that it says this. And there's a little bit of timidity because we know, hey, we don't think you're going to like what we're about to tell you, but actually it's this. And so what you're basically doing is you're treating, and you know, say in that case, like progressivism as though it's the default operating system. And then you're trying to like, hey, come back a little bit maybe. Mm-hmm. And it's very timid, as opposed to assuming the center and acting like, no, this is just good news. There's a great example of this. I think it's about a year ago, Harrison Butker, the kicker for the Chiefs.
Okay.
Gives this talk at he's a Catholic. He gives a talk at like a little Catholic college in Kansas or Nebraska or someplace like that. And in it, he basically, and it's like a very typical graduation speech, you know, like you're going to do great things. But in the process, basically in passing, kind of mentions like, hey, you know, you ladies, I know that a bunch of you want to be wives and mothers and you should do it. And my wife, Isabel, loves being a wife and a mother and it's been great. And guys, you want to do great things and pursue glory and you should go do it. But it was this very like, and it just was it blew up in the sense of like ESPN is having to put out statements like
I remember this now.
The city of Kansas City puts out a statement that Harrison Butker does not speak for us. The NFL is like, Harrison Butker does not speak for all of the NFL. And there's this like panic mode of like, what he just said. And it was that feminism kind of hitting that note of just like, my wife likes being a wife and a mom and ladies, you should too. But the issue was not just what he said, because he could have said it in a kind of an apologetic, like, hey, girls, I know that you maybe want to go be a career woman, but hey, did you maybe want to think about whether bearing children could be cool too? Like maybe that could be one of your choices. Like it wasn't that. It was just like, this is great and you should do it.
Yeah.
And it was the way he said it that was so offensive, because he acted like his marriage, right, a biblical Christian marriage, husband leading, wife submitting, prioritizing a family, all this stuff, he acted like it was just normal and good. And it was deeply offensive to a whole bunch of people. And it's like, that's assuming the center, and something that Christians really have. And the way you do that is you have to live under the divine gaze. Like this is the, you can't fear man, you have to fear God. So even, you know, earlier when we were talking about your, people have this kind of like imaginary unbeliever that they're talking to as opposed to the people in their church. Even more fundamental of that, right, is like, I want to speak in such a way that God says amen.
Yeah.
Right? That what I'm saying, he goes, yes, that his gaze is the one that actually matters to me. And then because of that, he goes, hey, disciple your people, encourage the saints, and make it clear to unbelievers. That's your task. And if you do both of those, if you say true things and encourage the saints, and if you make it clear to unbelievers, even if they reject it, you will get a well done, good and faithful servant.
Yeah, that's so good, and we just have to be honest. I mean, we all try to mortify the flesh and mortify that people pleaser in us. Every message, I try to sit there and go, Lord, help me right now. I confess, I'm thinking about how this person or that person is going to go, oh, great job, great message. Yep. And I just have to say, Jesus, I'm sorry. Please forgive me. I want you to be the one who's pleased in this message first and foremost above all things. I'm doing a message this week on 1 Peter 3, where the church is referred to as the pillar of truth. And I'm so excited for this message. I'm going to both, of course, 1 Timothy was written in the context or sent to Timothy, who was in Ephesus. And so you have the Temple of Artemis there, which had a zillion temples in this football stadium sized building. And then of course there were the two major pillars at the temple in Jerusalem. And one of the points I'm making amongst many is this idea that the pillars provided a safe, strong, secure environment for all those who are underneath the protection of that structure.
Right.
And what I'm getting at relative to what you're saying with centering Christian truth is, I'm just trying to say, I get our culture does not always respond to our approaches to centering in the same way, but that is what we're doing. We are the pillar of truth that is providing that safe, secure environment for people to live and prosper. And I think it's great to think of it like that instead of apologetic and is it okay if I say this? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and so I've got a friend, my friend Josh Dawes is writing a book right now for Canon called The Idol of Evangelism. And the big thing that he's going after is the way that the church tried to become God's PR department. And he's really getting at this, but like that, the image of the pillar, really does, you know, it's why, you know, Samson puts his hands on the two pillars and he knocks them down and the entire, you know, all, the Philistine civilization collapses basically. Right. As the whole thing. And so if you assault the pillars, that's the foundations. That's the thing that's holding everything up. Whereas if you have strong pillars, and that's what the church should be, holding up the truth, and then the truth acts as kind of the shield that keeps out the elements in the storm from the people who are sheltering beneath it. I think that's absolutely, absolutely right.
I love that. I'm writing down the Samson image because that's not in the message. I don't know if I can squeeze it in, but that's so good. You know, the thing is, though, and not to overplay this point, but the thing, and then I'll spend a considerable amount of time on this particular topic, back to the issue of people pleasing versus God pleasing first. The tough thing is, even though we're called to be those pillars, the culture is at times the one pushing back on the pillars that we're trying to be. And you really, really have to die to wanting the culture to sit there and applaud you and say, good job, because there are times that to be the pillar God calls you to be means that in some weird truncation of the Samson picture, they're the ones trying to push us to topple.
That's right. Well, and even more than, you know, part of the way that the progressive gaze operates is it does it so indirectly. So some people who would go, I don't care what the world thinks, but they do care what certain other Christians who are calibrated by the world thinks. And I think this was like a key kind of penny drop for me at some point in the last few years was realizing because I would hear Christians criticize kind of the moderate third way sorts of Christians who were kind of sitting out the culture war. We're not doing that anymore. And they would say, you guys are just trying to please the world. And I think a lot of those folks legitimately said, no, we're not. We don't care what the New York Times thinks. We don't care what CNN thinks. And I think they meant it. The issue is that they were in environments where the other Christians were nice, respectable Christians. And so it wasn't that, you know, the New York Times didn't care what they said. They weren't even paying attention. But if they said something that other people, other Christians didn't like, that's the actual gaze that was steering them. That was the one that was actually manipulating them because they were trying to make sure that we're the right kind of Christian. We're not like those Christians. We're not like those Christians. And there's a great irony, right, in certain people going like, you know, okay, I'm trying to be like, I thank you, God, that I am not like, you know, and it's like, I think there's a parable about this one, actually. I think that one's in there. We should go look that one up, that if you find yourself doing that and trying to distance yourself from other Christians in order to win a hearing for the gospel with the world, like you're right. So when I say that, like I feel this, but come in the other direction because I'm tempted to want to say like that the third way, the squishy kind of Christians, I would be tempted to want to distance from them. And so I have to go like, no, like if they're genuine Christians, they're still my people. Like we're all a part of the same covenant people of God. And I think they're wrong and they need to knock it off. And so I want to, you know, I want to be Paul to Peter. I think that they're withdrawing from things. I think that they're cowardly. I think they're doing things they shouldn't do. And so I want to confront it, but I want to do so as though that they are my people and not a like, and not a like, hey, I'm trying to win favor with these, you know, secular right-wing folks by throwing Christians under the bus. It's like, if you guys want to come in, great, but you're coming into a family that includes that guy. Like he's in too, you know? And it's like, he's in. So this is, and it's an important thing for Christians to go like, who are your actual people?
Yeah. I think it's, it always breaks my heart when I feel like Christians are establishing their bona fides by kind of talking down other Christians or other expressions of faith. It just feels like, come on, we've got to do something that's more attractive, more intentional, more proactive than that. A couple things I want to get at that you cover in your books, and one is the overall topic of sober-mindedness. In some ways, we kind of teased around the edges of this in talking about the importance of holding all of the virtues in place at the same time, and that's, I think, probably an expression or working out of sober-mindedness. But maybe you could just talk about when it comes specifically to our passions / emotions and empathy, why sober-mindedness is such a big deal, and perhaps even define what sober-mindedness is until you wrote your book and I read it. I did not realize how many times this topic comes up in scripture. I wasn't unfamiliar with it, but boy, you start studying it, you realize this is actually quite a big deal.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. It's one of those words, I think for a long time, it's one of those Bible words that you just kind of like gloss over. Because you read these passages and it's like, you know, therefore, you know, girding up the loins of your mind and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you. And we're like, oh, set your hope on the grace, right? And you're like, wait, there's this little phrase in there. What did that mean? And so I don't remember, you know, both of these books kind of came out with my interaction with Edwin Friedman, this Jewish rabbi, family therapist guy who wrote a bunch of books on family systems and leadership and things. And he talks about self-differentiation as the key thing for leadership. And he means like you have boundaries, you know where you end and other people begin. You're connected to them, but you're not swallowed by them. You're not fused, codependent with them, enmeshed with them. So a well-differentiated person with a non-anxious presence was his kind of definition of a leader. And you're just like, that's cool. I'm an academic and read books with words like that. But like, I need to be able to talk to normal people. So what's the Bible term for that? Yeah. And at some point, the light bulb went off and it was like, it's sober-mindedness. So the idea of sober-mindedness, right? There's the word sober, right, is the opposite of drunkenness. So you go, okay, what's drunkenness? Well, drunkenness is when you consume so much alcohol that you're physically, emotionally, and morally impaired, right? You stagger, you can't walk straight. That's why they make you walk that line. Your judgment's impaired. You can't think straight. Your reflexes are slow. You're kind of groggy, and all that's drunk on alcohol. Okay, so what does sober-mindedness mean when it's not talking merely about drunkenness? And the answer is, well, you can be drunk on more than just alcohol. You could get drunk on your emotions. You could be drunk on your passions. Passions, those kind of like knee-jerk, spontaneous, snap reactions that we have to stuff, whether it's anger or fear or desire or pity. Like these are these emotions that kind of are really, really powerful, and they can get us by the throat. When those rise up, sober-mindedness says, I'm not going to be morally, physically impaired by those emotions. I'm going to keep my head. And so I just basically, kind of prompted me to go on this kind of Bible study where I'm looking at all the places in the New Testament, especially where that virtue is commended.
Yeah.
You realize that in leadership contexts, 1 Timothy, Titus, places like that, 1 Peter, sober-mindedness is commended as a kind of anchor virtue where it's always in the list of what elders must be, for example, because it's a key trait when it comes to Christian maturity. Like mature people are not tossed. Paul says, don't be like children, tossed to and fro, grow up to manhood. And so being tossed, whether by doctrine or by emotions, that's immature, that's childish. Well, so what's mature? Well, it's being steady, stable. So I kind of came up after looking at all the texts, sober-mindedness is having a clarity of mind, a stability of soul, and a readiness to act. And so it's those three. So clarity of mind, you're not cloudy, groggy, you see straight, you're not blinded by your emotions, but you see the situation for what it is. Because why? Because you're stable, right? There's an anchor. You have some ballast in your boat. Christian sober-mindedness means that ballast is the fear of the Lord. Like you are anchored in who God is. You fear him. You worship him, reverence him. So there's some ballast there, gravity there that kind of when the storms come, you're just like, no, I can plow right through it. And then you're not passive, apathetic, and checked out. Because you could have somebody who goes like, oh, I see it, and they're just totally chill because they're rocked back and this ain't my problem. No, sober-mindedness says, like, and I'm ready to do something about it. I'm ready to do my duty, to take responsibility in this scenario. And so when that cluster is a core virtue for every leader, whether in the home, whether in a church, a school, in the nation, wherever you're at, that virtue of sober-mindedness does kind of anchor a whole host of other virtues.
It can't be overstated how important everything you just said is when it comes to this value of sober-mindedness. It strikes me though that if somebody is wrestling with where they're not sober-minded, in some ways they're like the worst person to assess that. I feel like on the one hand they could assess it by, do they match up to the three descriptors that you just gave? Would you say there are any warning signs that if someone is starting to get drunk on their own emotions, here's how this is going to present? If you're starting to go down that road, here's what you're going to see, feel, perceive that could start your dashboard lights are flashing. Hey, pay attention right now.
Yeah, good. It's important to recognize that like reactivity would be kind of the opposite. So like that's when your passions are in the driver's seat and you're just kind of reacting. That could mean that you're certain people are like the blow up people. Like when they get reactive and their passions are raging, it's like they're big and loud and things like that. There's another kind of person just as reactive who just shuts down, walls off, walks away, taps out. That's just as reactive. So you go, well, I'm not blowing up. And it's like, yeah, but you're avoiding. Mm-hmm. You're just like, you're not aggressive, you're passive aggressive. And so either one of those are reactive. And like, I think the key thing would be like one of the key kind of in leadership and emotional sabotage, the most actionable piece of diagnostic advice is basically pay attention to your passions, reluctances, hesitations, snap reactions, whatever you want to call it. So there's going to be situations, for example, in your home where we become very adept at conflict avoidance mm-hmm. by just kind of like doing this little move right here, right? Where you're just like, oh, I see it coming. And I just like, oh, I'm good at dodging that by like shying away from conflict or blowing up when somebody says something. And it's like, pay attention to when you're doing that. Pay attention to when you mute yourself in a conversation because you're afraid of the reaction that you might get. That could be wisdom. I want to create some space for like, it could be wisdom that says, hey, now's not the time to make that comment.
Sure.
But I saw somebody had a little proverb that was basically like, when courage is required, the cowards always say that prudence is what's required. Right. You know, so like when courage is, when the need is like, say it, like cowards are always like, ah, we need to have wisdom. And it's like, that is true. But it's possible. It's possible. Now's not the right time. And so are you going to find the right time? But that avoidance, that conflict avoidance idea, as a pastor, I remember, I don't know if I tell the story in the book, maybe I said it there, but it's sort of this, like, I remember one time getting ready for a sermon on 1 Peter 5. And I was talking about the task of eldering, what do pastors do? And I wanted to say that pastors, you know, they lead the flock and they feed the flock and, you know, this kind of stuff. And I wanted to put in my sermon, elders rule the church. Because Paul says, the elders who rule well are worthy of double honor. So there's elders who rule well. It's a Bible word. And I remember typing my sermon and going like, elders rule the church. And every time I would try to write rule, I spelled it L-E-A-D. Huh. I could just feel it. Like I could feel like, yeah, I don't want to say that word. And I had been developing these sorts of like diagnostics. And I was like, okay, now there's a big timeout for me as a sermon prep to kind of go, why? What? Where's that? There's a reluctance to write the word rule in my sermon. It means that I'm kind of implicitly aware of something in my congregation, that if I say the word rule, something bad will happen. What is it? And so I just started like, and so basically it was like, once you have that reaction, you feel it, like, I don't want to write the word rule, even though it's a Bible word. And then now I'm going to go time out, and I'm going to step outside and I'm going to examine, where's that coming from? What's underneath it? And as I did, like in that circumstance, it was like, well, there's been a bunch of scandals recently where, like, you know, Ravi Zacharias had just happened and they've already found out about what a snake he was and abusing his power and authority. There have been other things like that. And so I was like, there's lots of these scandals about kind of abusive, domineering snakes. And if I say the word rule, people are going to hear it through that. And so I was like, okay, that's part of it. I said, the other thing is we live in kind of an anti-authoritarian, kind of egalitarian society that just doesn't like the idea of rule at all. Right. You know, nobody rules anybody here.
Yeah,
and right. So I was like, so there's a cultural thing there. And so I just kind of started to kind of get underneath, like, where, what was it? And then I was like, okay, so I should put up some guardrails. So, hey, when I say rule, I don't mean the domineering kind. And the nice thing about that is 1 Peter 5 mentions, don't be domineering. So I was like, hey, it's in the text. It's right there. I'm just going to preach the Bible. But I want to recover and say, it is the task of elders to take this responsibility of ruling the church. So it's like I had to lean in and get over it and like actually say the thing that might alienate certain members of my audience. But I wouldn't have, if I wasn't self-aware enough to realize how I was dodging hard truth, then I would have just kind of merrily gone along the way and said something true. Elders lead the church. There's nothing wrong with that. Right. But it was like, but it, there is something wrong with it if I say that in order to avoid saying something else true.
Well, and totally. And the thing is, some of the probably the most important application you need to do at unpacking on even what it means to lead.
Yeah,
you almost have to force yourself to encounter some of the barriers and the sort of the mental framework that even gets in the way of even the idea of leadership by itself, because all those same factors are still in play. One thing I would throw out here, and I don't know if you would agree with this or not, but I was doing a men's conference not long ago, and I said to the guys, I really challenged them to be aware of their emotions. And I think sometimes what happens, particularly with men, is because they don't always have the same emotions as women, and they don't present in the same way, they tend to consider themselves as less emotional or unemotional.
Right.
And I said, guys, I really believe you're just as emotional, or maybe not just, I don't know, but you're an emotional being just like your wife is. I just think you oftentimes will have different kinds of emotions that present in different ways. And what I appreciate with regard to what you're saying is those little hesitations, those little fears, those little anxieties, those are all emotions that we need to pay attention to.
Right. That's absolutely right. Yeah. So, when people say women are emotional, men aren't, that's not true. Whether it's degrees or presentation, however you cast that out in a couple different ways, but it is simply the case that like men have, human beings have, spontaneous, I don't want to say uncontrolled, but like semi-controllable reactions to reality. You know, like if your dog dies, you're just sad. Right. And men actually will embrace this when it comes to certain things where it's like, oh, it's appropriate if your hunting dog died. and for you to feel sad about that is like, that's okay. Right. And so it's like, which issues are you allowed to feel emotional about? But the key thing in all of them is for both men and women is that your emotions need to learn how to salute Jesus. Like they need to obey. And that's the thing in the modern world where it's like, no, emotions just are. The idea of making them obey and saying, well, if your emotions are telling lies to you, you should tell your emotions to take a hike. You should tell them to knock it off. And you should have the fortitude of mind. This is like related to the sober-mindedness, a kind of like strength of mind to not listen and follow your emotions, your passions, whenever they are raging, but instead to sort of be able to get the emotional distance necessary to collect yourself and then to act with wisdom, to act with intentionality and purpose, and not to simply be one more emotional domino, because that's what happens in these highly anxious, reactive systems, is that everybody is just an emotional domino, and once you hit one, it's just like, brrr, and they're all falling.
Yeah.
And leaders need to be the people who, when they hit it, it just goes thunk. Because you're not just an emotional domino.
I would love that. One of the questions I wanted to ask you was the nature of how emotions, empathy even, can be contagious within a system or within a community. And the flip side of that too, you know, I think sometimes the negative things that such as untethered empathy can be contagious, but so can courage. Talk to me about that from the scripture. Yeah. Talk about how we see it in real life.
Yeah, good. So, one of the reasons why empathy is dangerous, even the good kind, because if empathy just means emotion sharing, which is what some people mean by it, then you go, is that a good thing? And you go, yes, sometimes, right? Because which emotions are we sharing?
Yeah.
But if you've encouraged, like, hey, we want lots of emotion sharing, and you go, well, there's biblical precedent for this. Weep with those who weep, rejoice with those who rejoice. That's emotion sharing. That's good. But if you've conditioned people to just, you know, feel in each other and just like this emotion comes flowing in and then it flows into the next person, what you end up with is a big blob of emotion. And it's really difficult once the emotions are churning to keep your head and to not go along with whatever the most emotional and reactive and immature member of that community wants to do, because everybody is trying to like take their cues from that person. So, so even if it's good, and it is, it's dangerous. And there needs to be a sense of like, I sympathize with you. I join you in that emotion. But again, I'm tethered and anchored to something sturdy so that I don't get swept off my feet. If you start blaspheming God, I am not going to validate your emotions, right? And I think a good example of that in the Bible is Job, when he and his wife have just been put through the most horrific thing possible. Not just the loss of all of their property and their wealth, but 10 children dead like that because of a freak accident, right? That we know is Satan's work, but they didn't. They just see, that the house fell down. And as he's sitting there in his sores, like now he's been afflicted with sores, his wife comes and says, Are you still holding fast your integrity? Like, you're still clinging to that God of yours? Just curse God and die. And if, as a pastor, you zoom out and you go, okay, wait, here we have a mother who just lost 10 beloved children. And in her grief and anger and sadness, she's angry at God and is trying to get her husband to join her in that anger at God and to curse God. And I go, man, it'd be really easy to do, honestly, right? Like, it'd be really hard to just go like, no, that's not true.
Right.
I'm not going to curse God. But that's what Job says. He's like, you were speaking foolishly. Like, yeah. Even in that moment, in his deepest grief, he's anchored to God to the point where he can look at his wife who's angry at God and angry at him for clinging to God and say, you're speaking foolishly. That's not true. Like, the kind of fortitude necessary and integrity necessary to like do that is remarkable and is probably why Job was one of the greatest men of his day, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that is what we're called to do and be as leaders, is to be the place where like you can absorb, like he's not offended by it personally, like he's not like taking it personally or whatever. He's just like reasserting what's true, right? Yeah. He's just saying, it's not true. I'm not going to allow you, your emotions, to drag me under. I'm going to cling to my God.
Well, and I love in the book, you use also the example of when Paul confronts Peter.
Yeah.
And it's such a great example. And also one of my favorite kind of throwdown matches in my mind of the New Testament, because here you have two greats, neither of whom was a kind of a subtle character. I mean, Paul knew how to mix it up and Peter knew how to mix it up. And Peter is pulling back from Gentiles. And Paul goes, hey, this behavior is contrary to the gospel. It's not in line with the gospel. And I need to have a sort of unemotional, fact-based, truth-based conversation and call out this behavior. Now, with our remaining minutes, Joe, one thing I want to make sure we get to do, in the midst of, and we've sort of alluded to this, but in the midst of all of the talk of where we can go wrong with empathy, I want you to give your best pastoral coaching for when somebody really does want to meet somebody in a place of suffering. And we started to tease it out a little bit with the Job story, but in your everyday life, and you actually in the book, you talk about, hey, here's what it looks like to kind of really meet some. And so if for the person out there is going, okay, you've told me all the things that are risks and dangers, but just like this person's hurting and what do I do? And do I always say, no, God's still good right in the moment? Or do I wait? Or how do I affirm what they're feeling without saying, I agree with you? What do I do, Joe? I just want to let this person know that God sees them and I do too. How do I do that?
Yeah, good. And that was a big burden for me in this, as I was realizing the ways that empathy and compassion were going wrong and being tools of manipulation. It was like, okay, well, I don't want to lose the good. Because the devil masquerades as an angel of light, and that doesn't mean that the other angels don't then decide, well, we guess we have to change our clothes, right? Because we don't want to look like the devil. So it's like, what's still the virtue? And so like I developed at some point over the last 10 years, this kind of like four statements that when I think about comforting those in affliction, and my dad passed away 10 years ago. I've sat with families whose 11-year-old son was killed in a freak farming accident. Had friends who've buried babies. Our dog did just die last week. And I had to comfort my 13-year-old who really loved that dog. And so it's like, what am I doing in those moments where there's real pain and I want to actually help them? So the four statements that I don't necessarily say to them, they're more like my operating instructions, like what am I trying to communicate, is these four statements. One is, this is hard. And that's an important statement because that's an objective one. It's like, I'm not making any, are they feeling the right way? It's just like, whatever's the case, whether they're rightly emoting or wrongly emoting, or it's a mix of both or whatever, it's like, this is just hard. So I want to find a way to communicate by my words and my actions, my facial expressions, everything, like, hey, this is hard. Second thing is, I know you feel that way. So this is, and I put it that way because it's like I'm acknowledging their felt reality without necessarily endorsing, affirming, or validating that felt reality. Like I'm creating the space, if necessary, in my own mind, I'm going like, if they try to do the Job's wife thing, I'm ready to tap out because true biblical compassion reserves the right not to blaspheme. So it's like, but I can acknowledge you are, blaspheming. Yeah. I see it. I know you feel that way. So this is hard objectively. I know how you feel. I can see it. I see your feelings. And then the third is I'm with you. Okay, it's like I'm here. Like your emotions, the intensity of them aren't throwing me. Like I'm not recoiling, trying to get you to knock it off. Like it's like, I'm with you. Like I'm not scared of your emotions. I actually, because I'm tethered to God, I can be here with you and not worry that I'm going to get bowled over. So I'm with you and I'm here as long as you need me. And then finally, I have hope. And that's an important one because that's the tethering right there. Like that's the like, you may not be, you're in the pit and just everything's hopeless. Everything's despairing. You don't see a way out. Your grief, your anger, your whatever emotions are just absolutely, your guilt, whatever it is, has just blind, you're so under it that you can't see the sun anymore. But I need you to know that I'm here with you in the same pit, but I still see the sun.
Yeah.
I still see the sun and I have hope and my hope is in Christ. And so I can acknowledge how hard it is. I can acknowledge your emotions. I can share them to some degree. I can be with you in them and I can say, but I have hope. And that doesn't necessarily mean like a corrective in the moment, like, hey, God works all things together for good. That's the sort of truth, honestly. God works all things together for good is true. And is the sort of truth that you want to like work into your soul. If you're a pastor, you want to work it into the souls of your people before they get to that hospital room.
Yeah.
Like before they're standing at the graveside, before the tragedy strikes, that truth needs to just be like down in the joints and marrow of their soul so that you don't have to like try to like insert it at the worst possible moment. Instead, there's just it's a steadiness to it. Like, yeah, we're grieving and it's hard. And we can just a look communicates like we know God's still good, and now we're going to cry our eyes out because we miss so and so or whatever. So this is hard. I know you feel that way. I'm with you in this, and I have hope.
There you heard it, everybody. Pastor, theologian, PhD, Dr. Joe Rigney is not anti-compassion.
He's not
anti-sympathy. He just wants to help us love people in a biblical, godly way that will ultimately lead to life and prospering and a good, healthy moving forward from places of pain and grief. So thanks for unpacking that, Joe, and appreciate so much this conversation today. Is there anything else you'd like to share? And let us know how we can get a hold of you, stuff like that.
Yeah, good. So, the only social media I have is X. It's Joe_Rigney. So, when I do things, they usually show up there if you want to keep following. The thing I'd actually like, maybe, I don't know what your audience does for like, entertainment and edification and things, but Canon Plus, so Canon Press is the publisher of these two books. Canon Plus is like their subscription service. It's basically kind of a combination of Netflix and Audible. So it's got like the audio books and it's got the books like of, Christian books, but it's also got like kids' stories and things for the kids. It's got some kids shows, like old school cartoons that you don't have to like worry that they're going to indoctrinate them in gender insanity. It's like old school stuff, as well as some other TV shows. They're documentaries, Christian documentaries, sermons, books, everything. It's like this real great family package that you can kind of be like, hey, this is curated and put together by solid Christians. And so I just always like to be like, hey, if you're looking for something like that, families are looking for, hey, what are things we can do together, that can edify and encourage and be fun? CanonPlus.com, you can go find that. And I do know this, Joe99 will get you 1 month for 99 cents. So like they gave me my own little like promo code thing and I am like, okay, cool. So, Joe99, if you want to go at least try it for a month and just see what's all in there, but that'd be a great way to build up the family. And both these books are on there for as part of that subscription.
Oh, is that cool? Yes. Well, that's great to know. I didn't, I've read the books, but I've not heard or seen about Canon Plus, so I'll check it out.
Yeah.
And I think of not just for my own needs, but I just think of, man, when you are raising younger kids, now we're beyond the stage of raising our kids, but man, did we have to work hard to find good resources that would build them up in faith and in worldview. Yeah. So that is a tremendous resource. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again so much for being on the show today, Joe. It's just absolutely a delight to talk with you, and I appreciate your ministry, appreciate your writing, and keep up the great work. Do you have do you have another book coming out that I need to be waiting with bated breath here, or what?
Yeah, I've got a couple that I'm working on at the moment. So we've got actually a book on Negative World that it's a multi-author that we're working as interacting with that thesis and kind of, you know, extending it and things like that. So that's I'm finishing up the editing in that in the next month or so. And that one will be out soon. And then I'm working on a book on Puddle Glum's faith. So I like Narnia and Puddle Glum's great.
You do.
I do. And so we're going to do some little Puddle Glum. So that one's kind of in the works as well. And then there's probably going to be the two books that we've talked about, Leadership and Emotional Sabotage and then Sin of Empathy. There's probably going to be a third one on Leadership and Desire.
Okay.
That gets going to get into the envy, rivalry, space, things like that, kind of there's a particular thinker. And I think it'll be another kind of like paradigm shift sort of book for folks. So that one's still early development, but that's probably in the next year. I'm hoping to chip away at those.
Cool. Keep it up, Joe. I look forward to a future conversation with when some more of your work comes out.
Yeah. Excellent. Thanks, Brian.
Yeah. Have a great day. Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Dr. Joe Rigney. And one of the biggest takeaways for me was, hey, emotions are not king. Jesus is. And if you were encouraged, if you were equipped by that conversation, let me encourage you to rate and review Made to Advance. That's such a great help to our show. This has been a production of Engedi Church, and we have more incredible conversations on the way. And so until next time, please know God made you to advance.